Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Cybercrime and espionage campaigns on the internet are on the rise. Russia, the US, China, and many other countries are very actively engaged in this activity. Many tools used by hackers originate in the US or in other government-backed programs. The internet is like the Wild West of cybercrime, with few people knowing what's even going on. This episode, we are welcoming back Bob Weiss, ethical internet hacker and security expert, to talk all about these issues.
Hi, Bob. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks, Sarah.
Well, I could have you on every week with all the stuff going on in the cybercrime world lately, huh?
Yeah, it's been interesting.
We had a person on, Zach Brower, who talked about what Apple was up to, and they're building a big data warehouse for cloud data in China.
Yeah.
And I wanted your, before we dive into all sorts of other stuff, I wanted your opinion on that. And what does it mean? I mean, is our data going to be stored in foreign countries? I mean, what happens if our data is not being stored in our country?
Yeah, and you know, that's an interesting subject, and I appreciate you, you know, bringing it up, frankly, because it's something I had to look into to prepare for our chat today. But the bad news is nobody knows where the data is being stored. Now, the work that Apple is doing in China is really at the request of the Chinese government, and the Chinese government basically is saying, you know, we don't want our people's data stored outside of our political boundaries. And, you know, one of the charms, of course, of the internet is that it just totally ignores political boundaries.
Well,
it turns the world into one big connected place.
Exactly. And China's doing what the United States should do and say, we don't want our data stored elsewhere, but the United States isn't going to do that because, right, it's legal for them to look at all our data if it's stored out of this country, whereas if it's stored here, it's illegal for them to do that. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, that's one of the interesting little nuances of governmental spying in the internet age is that, you know, if you're constrained by, say, a pesky thing like a constitution or national law, you can offshore and access the same information in a place where those laws don't exist. But the Chinese kind of bring up an interesting thing that I think many governments are beginning to wonder about. And, you know, here in the United States, you know, certain regulated industries like, you know, financial industry, the medical industry, you know, people who are regulated by HIPAA and HITECH are, and SOX, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley and things like that. Well, you know, okay, so now we're moving all our stuff out to the cloud, but is it really in our control? Where is it? And if it is overseas, or if it's being mirrored, and you know, part of the charm of these online services is that your data is actually being mirrored in several places, so that if a data center were to be taken out in some sort of catastrophic event, that your data would still be secure over here in this other place where we've got it copied. And, you know, is it mirrored in Ireland? What does that mean?
Exactly.
And how does that impact my compliance to these other regulations? So this is another little snarl that is going to have to be worked out.
Well, you know how me and my husband both came from telecommunications. We all came from telecommunications. So this is kind of our background. But my husband worked at US West, Baby Bell. He was in charge of the security for a while there, and he used to meet with all the different government officials and set up all the security paradigms for US West. And he had to work with all the different other AT&T and all the different Baby Bells at the time. And to this day, he will not store anything on the cloud or anything other than local because of what he learned through all that experience. And it really tells you, anybody who's closely involved with that are the people who are the most worried.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, no matter how you store your data, it's at risk for something. Okay, even if you were to just simply memorize everything, which would be difficult, but you know, I have no copy.
My brain is capable of memorizing everything.
Yeah, yeah, and but you know, somebody with the right kind of, shall we say, coercive of appliances may be able to get you to spill your beans. You know, I mean, it's you know, you put it on a flash drive, you lock it in a, you know, you lock it in a safety deposit box. Okay, yeah. But then the safety deposit box, of course, is subject to, you know, subpoena and search, you know, search warrants, properly executed search warrants. And so, you know, nothing is 100%. I think that there's a place for, you know, I mean, local backup is convenient in that it's always quicker to restore from a local archive. You know, some type of a far, far away backup, whether it's, you know, cloud-based or whether it's, you know, a server that you paid for in a server farm somewhere where you're backing things up.
Well,
is nice from the standpoint of, you know, if there's a catastrophic event in your neighborhood, like a, you know, a tornado or earthquake or something like that, the original data and the local backup are subject to the same hazard. The third copy out in the far, far away, however you achieve that, gives you the ability to recover, you know, in the event of
sure.
a release.
Yeah, and that's the whole point, is for recovery right. purposes. There are some clinics now, health clinics, I know one that's in Wisconsin, that has all their health records stored in an underground facility where only two executives in the company know where it's at, mm-hmm. and it's all disconnected from the internet. So,
yeah.
I mean, so and I guess they have two places like that, so it's redundant storage. So that is, you know, taking it to a level that is much safer. But let's face it, the majority of the health clinics and things, they're storing it on the internet online or yep. maybe locally, and it's all connected to the internet with very poor security, and
yep.
it's crazy. But then it comes to a whole nother level. If it's on the internet or in cloud storage, it could be stored in Ireland or China or anywhere. And then once it's stored elsewhere, then it's legal for the government to look at it. What happens if cyber criminals look at it?
Well, and they are. And that's an interesting part of the book. I just finished reading Brian Krebs' new book, Spam Nation. And he kind of goes into, he starts out looking at, you know, spamming. And
isn't he the one, before you go on, isn't he the one that identified the Target breach?
Yeah.
Okay.
A year ago, you know, very nearly exactly a year ago, he was the one who released the information that Target had been breached and really had, you know, the early handle on
Target got hosed because there's so many other even bigger breaches since then, but Target was the first one, so they got... They got the sledgehammer.
Yeah, they were the poster child, and there have been, you know, in the last 2 year period, I mean, there were breaches similar to Target's that occurred prior to Target, but were revealed after Target because, you know, it's kind of like, oh, heck, we better look. And then they look and they find out that for, like, you know, the period of 200 days or, you know, basically two thirds of a year, they've been coughing up their
You know what's silly, and you got to get back to this book that you were talking about, but what's silly is Target breach goes out and everybody has to change all their credit cards. I think, you know, I know about 10 people that had to get my credit card had to be changed out, but larger breaches happened since. Breaches happened before that, and we didn't change out our credit cards for anything else. So it's simply because of the PR that Target got that the banks are changing all that out. How come they're not doing it for these other larger breaches?
Well, part of the reason is that, quite frankly, you know, replacing credit cards is not a free move for these guys. And what they're finding, okay, you know, so here's a statistic, and I just happened to read this. It was somebody had interviewed Brian Krebs online or I don't remember. It was a media, you know, it was like television or radio media thing, and I heard him talking about this thing. And, you know, for Target, it's 40 million cards, roughly speaking. And, of those cards, maybe only 10% were actually sold and used. And so the credit card
companies. That's still 4 million.
Yeah. The credit card companies are taking the approach rather than sending out new cards every time there's a big breach. Because what they're waiting to do is they're monitoring for fraudulent activity. And in the case, you know, in the instances where they find that somebody's account is being actively used, then they'll change out that one individual. So we're not going to see.
Because it's cheaper.
False replacements.
Because that's cheaper.
But if you get it, if your card's being used, yeah, if your card's being used fraudulently, your credit card company will let you know that and turn your card off and send you a replacement. So supposedly the chip and pin technology that's coming around next year is going to fix a majority of the problems because of the thing. Okay, so I steal credit card number. I have it in a big pile. And I sell them in groups, you know, from as few as, say, 5 numbers to as many as several thousand numbers in a bump. And the people who use these cards basically manufacture plastic cards with the credit card information encoded on them. The magnetic stripe cards make that a very trivial thing to do. It's very simple. You need, you know, a little piece of equipment that you can buy online. That, you know, it's used for like encoding gift cards and hotel room keys and any number of things. So you can buy these things legitimately.
So what do they do? What do they do with these?
They basically manufacture the card and then they go out and they, the basic deal is spend money until the card is, you know, restricted. And so you'll pay for it.
And they're kind of immune from any, people going after them because it's too expensive for the companies to go after them, so they just shut it down, don't they? I mean, do they go after these people.
Well, it might get reported to the local PD if there's surveillance cameras, which nearly every place on the planet has those now. There may be an attempt made to try and figure out who you are. Typically, the people who are actually using the card
do it online,
Well, not necessarily. They go in the store and buy high-value stuff that can be sold elsewhere. Apple gear, for instance, can be purchased in the United States and sold in Europe and you know, especially Eastern Europe and Russia for vastly more money than what it costs to buy it here. And so there's the profit on two ends where you paid $4 for a card where you're getting $400 or $500 out of it. And then there's the resale value of the resale profit of the goods that you sold overseas. But
if they're getting them on camera, shouldn't they be able to nail some of these guys?
Yeah, sure, and some of them are.
Okay.
Most of the card, you know, the actual guys who are standing in a checkout line using the card are garden variety thieves.
They're the small time. It's the people that are It's the distributor of the card, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the bigger part of the organization is off-season, and they're just simply selling information of one type or another. And that's the other thing that came out of the Krebs book is that the business of cybercrime has moved to basically being the acquisition and sale of information. All information has value to someone. And so it's not that they're just going after credit card information or even personal identity information, but in all forms of information, including, you know, secret plans and patents and formulas and stuff like that. All that stuff has value, and it's being collected any number of ways and sold online.
So, what is going on with this? Is it called Regan tool used for it's for espionage campaigns by Russia? Right? Is that who's doing it? Did they build it?
Yeah, it looks like it's coming out of Russia. It has the look and feel of being a government-sponsored tool in that the confirmed infections are happening primarily in Russia itself, which means the government would be spying on their own people with it.
That's not new.
Yeah, and you know, one of the rules for cyber criminals everywhere is, you know, don't pee in your own pool. And so if you're a Russian cyber criminal, the very last place on the planet that you're going to be attacking is anything in Russia. You'll focus all your efforts.
So that's why they overseas. Think it's a it's
that's
a
why
Russian.
They think it's local.
Well, what are they doing? How does it work, and what do you think they're doing with it?
Not entirely sure. You know, another place that is you know, heavily involved in the Reagan attacks or Saudi Arabia, which, you know, what is that all about?
Oil?
Is it about money? Because that's what they got there. They've got oil and they've got money. Are they, maybe they're, you know, Russia has its Islamic terrorist groups too, you know, in Chechnya and places like that. And, so maybe they're, you know, maybe they're just doing anti-terrorism stuff for all we know. But at this point in time, it's too new to have a real solid, you know, idea of what's going on there. But it kind of looks like it's the Russian government. But the thing about these tools.
Well, and we know that the Russian government's doing this stuff. We know the U.S. Sure. government's doing this stuff. We know the Chinese government's doing this stuff. So it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. The question is, what are they doing with it?
Yeah. Well, and the other issue is that these tools don't stay. They never stay in the hands of the people who launch them. Basically, you know, some smart guy is going to pull the exploit out and reverse engineer and create a tool based on what they discovered that'll be available for cyber criminals and others who just want to, you know, either, you know, download and install it and use it or pay for it.
Well, yeah, they figure it out. So if Russia creates one or the U.S. creates one.
That's another problem with these wonderful little government-sponsored things is that try as they might, they're not very good about hanging onto their tools when they get out. People.
Other smarter people.
You know, just before the break, I was kind of moving into the Stuxnet, which isn't Russian. The Stuxnet was an interesting exploit that attacked very specific companies in the country of Iran that were engaged in their nuclear power and nuclear weapons program. And it was designed to work in the SCADA or shall we say, computer-aided manufacturing processes of their program, and specifically on certain Siemens centrifuges that were used for separating and purifying uranium. And this particular exploit caused those systems to overrun their limits and basically self-destruct by...
Oh, wow.
You know, through high-speed vibration, shall we say.
So it could it have a complete meltdown from this...
Yeah, basically they made it impossible for the Iranians to purify any uranium for a while. And
well, that sounds like the U.S. might have done that one.
Well, and that was
it. That's us. I mean, like, I don't know, obviously.
It's kind of like, was it U.S.? Was it Israel?
Israel would be very interested in that.
Yeah, yeah. And later on, I mean, about 2 years ago, a general, retired general from the United States, in an interview said, yeah, Stuxnet was us. And so he kind of pulled the curtain on what we already assumed was true. But what was interesting about Stuxnet was designed to go in and do its work and then self-terminate. It had a kill date built into the code. And when it got to be, you know, April 15th of whatever year, you know, I'm just pulling a date out of the air, but it had a kill date. Well, it didn't die the way that the U.S. had hope, because the Iranians, as it turned out, were using bootleg copies of Windows.
Oh, that's funny.
And if you want to run Windows, a Windows operating system, you can install it and you'd be
So they were using bootleg copies, so it didn't work the way it was supposed to.
So, you know, you get a 30-day evaluation period and then you have to license it. So what they did is they installed the operating system and then changed the system clock in the BIOS, you know, to go back 10 years. And so they had 30
So they had like 30 years of yeah, trial period.
Yeah, so they never, the kill date never came up.
So
on
what happened though? That's pretty serious.
Well, so Stuxnet got out and has been analyzed. And the problem with Stuxnet is that it can be, configured to be, I mean, this is a weapon. This is basically a weapon.
Well, yeah,
because
if the nuclear system resistor, whatever it is, melts down, that seems very dangerous. Or did it just shut down so they couldn't use it?
I'm sure wherever these, the rooms where these centrifuges came apart were uninhabitable for, many thousands of years. But there wasn't like a danger of explosion, but people were hurt or killed or both or whatever. But the thing is that this kind of code can be modified to go after, say, electrical control systems for power grid or water control.
Yeah, and that's what they're worried about.
And so
they're just going to take our weapon and reconfigure it and use it against us.
Yeah, exactly.
Woohoo!
Yeah, and this is the problem. Cyber war is kind of fun from the standpoint of nobody dies, and, there's no bullets, and there's no destruction.
It's kind of fun until it hits your own town, and you can't go anywhere.
But the problem is, this is a bullet you can fire twice.
Exactly.
So you basically snatch it off of your network, figure out what's going on, and then you send it back, return to sender with some more excitement added, kind of like.
Well, and that's why they're talking about all the power grids being at risk. I mean, it's been a big topic in the...
Yeah, power grids, water treatment facilities, water distribution, pipelines.
Well, people like China going towards solar power, they're essentially off a grid and individualized. That's much safer, isn't it? Because you're generating your own power, you're off the grid.
Yeah, you might think so, but who knows?
Yeah, there's probably something else.
Most of these utility systems are not internet connected, although some of them are becoming. But the thing is that if you can gain access, physical access, and get things started, then maybe it doesn't matter that you're not on the internet.
Well, you can tap into a private network, right? Even though it's not on the internet, just by being parked across the street.
You get a van, you throw a Comcast logo on it, and you find a shirt somewhere in Goodwill, and you walk in the door and you say, "I'm from Comcast. I need you to let me in the server room." And in a lot of places, that'll get it done. It just depends. People with these kind of skills, and especially governments, where they use regular, human intelligence, assets. Well, if you need to infiltrate a guy into a utility company in order to get something started, I'm sure it's not that tough to find qualified people.
Well, there's another infection out there called Wire Lurker.
Mm-hmm.
And that one looks like it's in China, and it originated in China, and it infects Mac iOS devices. That's like the iPad, iPhone, those kind of things.
Yep.
Well, I read something that it's been downloaded 350,000 times. So that's the origination point, 350,000 origination points, and then it spreads from there, right?
Yeah, exactly. And here again, this comes under the heading of, we're not sure what it does. It's a surveillance. It's another surveillance tool.
But how does it get in the software? I mean, that has to be...
But basically, what's happening is that the people who are distributing this are putting it in the Apple Store, but in other online marketplaces where you can download iOS apps for phones and computers and stuff. And the programs or the applications that seem to be affected have a bit to do with taking a look here. Yeah, that have to do with targeting. Hang on Yeah, okay. Basically, the applications are, the applications are trying to,
You're a busy guy.
Yeah, I had the phone ringing there. Sorry, you'll have to edit that chunk out. The WireLurker is looking for people who have pirated software installed on their systems. And so here again, this appears to be
a government deal.
Government sanctioned kind of a deal. Not sure, you know, because the Chinese have been using pirated software forever. I mean, that's what they do. They you know, buy a program and make a bunch of illegal copies and distribute it. But maybe what they're after is that, you know, the government is probably handling the licensing fees that they do collect, and these people are getting around that. It's kind of like, oh, no, you don't.
Yeah. But so
this one, again, is too new to know, but the fact that, you know, it's basically an application that is installed in addition to some other app that you download from an app store somewhere and install means that other people will repurpose this for their various nefarious ends and we'll see more of this. And this comes under, you know, I teach this security class. We've talked about that in the past. I teach it again. I always have some Mac users in the class who are kind of like, well, I'm a Mac user. Does this mean I'm not, you know, I'm safe? And it's like, well, maybe in the past, but not anymore. And since 2009, there's been a tremendous amount of work done to create iOS-based malware.
Well, as that becomes more and more commercially, you know, because before it used to be all Microsoft-based or the, in business. And now as the Macs start to really infiltrate that space, it's just going to be more and more of it.
Well, and it's kind of like this, you know, you've got a company in it that's all running Windows machines. Who's got the Mac? It's the CEO.
Yeah.
So in some cases, what we know about Apple consumers in general is that they tend to be wealthier and more upscale. They have, you know, better stuff to lose, basically, and make a more attractive target for any kind of a cyber criminal. But I just read today about an exploit. Forget the name of it, but there appears to be a coordinated effort going on by somebody in the cybercrime area after CEOs of major companies, and the idea here is to get insider information in order to basically make money in the stock market the old-fashioned way, with insider information and by trading stocks that are due to take a jump. And so they're targeting, like, you know, CEOs of pharmaceutical companies and the CEOs of companies that are in acquisition, you know, that are acquiring a company or being acquired, in order to get into their email accounts and learn little things that aren't public yet, so that they can
get insider trading.
Trade. Yeah, it's a straight insider trading deal, nothing too fancy or exotic about it. But the fact that the, you know, kind of surveillance software that we're talking about here is very easily, you know, can be very easily be used for these types of things too.
Well, what countries are you seeing most of this stuff coming out of?
Well, Brazil's popular because it's, you know, it's beautiful in Brazil. You know, nice climate, no extradition. Russia's still very big. China, a lot of stuff going on in India. And that whole sort of Asia.
So what do you think, what is the characteristics of the countries that you're seeing? Is there a pattern?
Most of them have, you know, shall we say, the best government that money can buy.
They're more corrupt.
Yeah. And in other words, most of these guys pay for protection from the police, and the basic understanding is that we're not going to pull any of our criminal activity inside the borders of the host country. You know, we're just going to be attacking other people outside. Brazil, I know there's been quite a bit of interesting activity on Brazilian banks that appears to originate in country. And Brazil, because it's, you know, shall we say, maybe less structured than some other countries. In Russia, I think it's the FSB, which has replaced the KGB. A lot of the guys in the FSB are on payroll of Russian cybercrime organizations as a security consultant.
So
they're getting paid to do independent work outside of their FSB role, and it's completely legal. In fact, as part of the Russian legal code, is that, you know, you can do that. You can be an FSB agent and still go get independent work.
This really is the wild, wild west, isn't it? I mean, it's just a big kludgy nightmare, because I can't even us who are, you know, me with my background, you're way more educated on this than I am right now, but even with my background, it just seems like a big quagmire of crap out there, and I don't know how you would deal with it. It's just a mess.
Well, and this is kind of the thing that I found really interesting about Brian Krebs's book. You know, he started out talking about spam. It's kind of like, why are we getting so much of it? Why is spam 80% of all email traffic? And what's really going on? And basically, the original, you know, Russian spammer guys who were doing this were sending out a big chunk of their spam involved, you know, Canadian, and I'm using finger quotes here, you know, air quotes, Canadian pharmacies where you can buy drugs much, much less expensively. Well, they were making a ton of money selling pharmaceuticals to people all over the world, but also in the United States.
And they weren't really from Canada, is that correct?
No, in many cases they'd get that the drugs would arrive in a package that had been shipped from India or China. And the thing is, though, is that all pharmaceuticals, for the most part, are manufactured in India and China, and India has a tremendous pharmaceutical manufacturing capability. And as it turns out, the drugs that you got from Russian spammers
were
in fact drugs.
They were in fact good stuff.
Yeah, they were legitimate, you know, legitimate drugs. And these guys had like customer service. If you called up and complained, they just refunded your money. The reason they did that is it was easier for them and less expensive in the long run for them to refund your money rather than to have you complain to your credit card company.
Sure.
And have a negative, because those negative, what they call chargebacks, those increase the percentage of your handling fees. So
they had a legitimate business. They were using Canada as just a front because it was more trustworthy, but they were really selling legitimate stuff, and it was actually kind of a good service if you think of it that way. As long as it was safe, good drugs, it was coming from the actual manufacturers.
Yeah.
I kind of like that.
I know, and that was the point is, you know, Brian went and interviewed some, you know, he found a few people who were willing to talk to him about their drug buys. And it's like, I mean, I have this prescription and it's like $1,200 a month if I buy it here in the United States.
And
I'm paying $30 to buy it wherever I'm buying it. And the drugs work just fine.
Because the markups are just crazy. One thing I'm learning, because I'm redoing my healthcare, and I used to do that for all my employees as well. And if you don't have insurance, it is 10 times more expensive. And even with insurance, it's a lot more expensive than you can buy just directly. So I don't get me on that, because I'm currently upset with that.
Well, and I have a post that I'm going to put out probably tomorrow that says, why are we always getting hosed in the United States? And it talks about, you know, in this case, it's like, why are we paying three times as much for the kind of internet and cable TV that someone, you know, we're paying $200 a month for a cable internet package that in France is $32 a month and includes your cell phone too.
Oh, you're kidding me! Because France has a really high cost of living. So you could say, if you were going to say Mexico or China or something, and say, well, their cost of living is so low.
Yeah.
But in France, it's just not the case.
Yeah.
So heck is that?
Twice the speed for one third the price.
We're getting raked through the coals.
But the thing that's kind of interesting about the online drug business is that the FBI and Interpol with the help of the pharmaceutical companies, who of course are charging like too much money in the United States. Go figure how that happened. Went after these Russian, you know, cyber groups that were selling the pharmaceutical drugs and kind of put them out of business.
Well, didn't they?
Through taking down their infrastructure, the hosting stuff and what have you.
So who took down the infrastructure? The U.S. government?
U.S. government, Microsoft.
But how were they allowed to do that if they were in India and Russia and these other countries? How did they go in and do that?
Well, the hosting, as it turned out, was being hosted in places like the Netherlands and...
Okay, for our friendlies.
Yeah, Northern California. Which is a big surprise, and places like that.
But
and,
why can't they just host it in their own country and they have no problems?
You know, it's a matter of bandwidth, and, you know, you need to have, if you're getting, like, thousands of people buying stuff on your website, you have to have some really, like,
that's
really
true.
Good internet connectivity.
But I would think they would now, but there was a huge PR campaign that you do not want to buy drugs out of Canada and all this other stuff. Yeah. I remember
that was all part of it. Well, anyway, so the drug business has kind of been killed. And so that's why we're starting to see things like ransomware, like the encryption thing where they encrypt all your stuff and then
If you don't allow a person to do legitimate business, then they're going to turn to crime.
Yeah. Well, and it's not like this was 100%
legitimate, because they were lying about Canada. But
for the most part, what they were doing was harmless.
Well, but it was legitimate in the sense they were lying about where it originated, which is. But the thing is that it all originates from there anyways, from India or wherever it was being manufactured. And we citizens have this prejudice that unless it comes from U.S. or Canada, we won't buy, you know, any place that feels Western, we won't buy it. But in reality, it's really coming from there anyways. So, and I agree, if you're buying drugs, it needs to be from a place that you can trust. And so I get that. But there, instead of shutting them down, and they're saving us so much money, I would like to see, you know, some legitimate way to get drugs for a lot less money, because why are we paying all this? Yeah. So a legitimate source is what should be done. But there's a lot of research to show that if you make it really, really difficult for a person to make money doing legitimate work, they will turn to crime.
Yeah, sure. Of course, because what's their choice now? Now, these guys were always, you know, just like super dodgy, and then there's the whole spamming bit, which...
Well, that's not good. And, I mean, there were some problems with it.
Yeah, the way they're sending all this spam, of course, is that they're taking control of thousands of, you know, PCs in your house and my house and all over the world and using them to send the spam. So there's certainly plenty of stuff that they're engaged in that is, you know, criminal activity, or at least, you know, against laws of countries. And interestingly enough, you know, importing drugs into, you know, for you and I to go and buy drugs online and have them shipped here, that's a violation of federal law.
Yeah, and I think that's wrong. If we need drugs to take care of something, I think we should be able to buy it wherever we need it, as long as we need it. We should be able to buy it. That you don't even want to get me started on this. I had issues with my health insurance just in this, and we got it all reestablished. But I, for a while there, for like a month while I was getting it all worked out, I had to buy drugs because my son has some acne, and so he's on this acne medication and so forth. And I couldn't believe how expensive some. So I'm seriously, my husband's from Mexico. I am seriously looking into, well, not now because I got it figured out. Seriously figuring out how do I get it from Mexico. It's a heck of a lot cheaper. Yeah. I'm just going to go get it from Mexico and they can bring it in because this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I'm not going to spend, you know, I should say 2% of my income on this prescription drug. I know 2% doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a lot.
Well, and why wouldn't the government, for instance, be interested in saving, like, billions of dollars on Medicare by bringing in drugs from these places. And the answer, quite frankly, is that the pharmaceutical companies contribute tons of money to election campaigns every year. And, you know, so it's really, or more to the point, why can't we buy our drugs in the United States for the same price that you could buy them in Nairobi? You know.
Well, because they have distributors too, right?
Why do
our pharmaceutical companies have to make 10 times more than they do in other countries? In France, now you can't argue with me that it's a cost of living thing if in France they're getting it for that, because cost of living in France is more expensive than here.
Yeah, and the thing that is kind of interesting is that the country of India basically refuses to recognize patents in the West and manufactures generic versions of most drugs that are very, very expensive. And their whole argument is, we're supplying drugs to Africa and Asia and the Middle East and places where people don't have the money to pay these outrageous prices, and we're just doing we're doing
humanitarian work.
Yeah, you know, public service. So, you know, sorry, we don't care. That recently changed a little bit because they were under pressure, you know, to recognize, you know, at least some of it. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, the argument that the pharmaceutical companies use is that we've got, you know, millions of dollars in research and development for all these drugs, and we have to get it back somehow. And one way we do it is charging, you know, 200
astronomical prices to get it. And I understand. You have to understand a little bit of that, because that is what the whole patent process was about. But when you're withholding life-saving medication from poor people because they can't pay for it because we got to get our patent money back, there's a problem with our system.
Yeah, and the other part of that is that a huge part of the cost in research and development for these companies, quite frankly, are meeting, you know, FDA regulations. Most drugs are released in Europe and other parts of the world as much as two decades earlier than they're available here, because there's so many hurdles jumped through our government. But anyway, we're kind of off.
I know, but it's so interesting. I could talk about this all day. We were supposed to talk about cybercrime. All this stuff is related to it, because that's what they were selling, and we're all trying to figure out. Well, you kind of touched on a soft spot right now, because I just have been going through this personally, and I was literally looking into it.
Yeah, and I felt actually kind of bad for these guys as they were starting to snap them up. It you know, cut the flow. Now, to be fair, some of the drugs that are coming into the United States are, you know, class one regulated painkillers and stuff like that, and they come in just the same way. And, you know, you can buy the oxycodone or Vicodin or whatever and online for one third of what it costs here in the United States, and then turn around and sell it on the street at, you know,
That's
$5 a pill.
That's a problem.
And there's a, you know, huge markup there.
That's a problem. We have such a bad drug problem, and we have so many issues. The issue is so much more complex.
Yeah.
So let's get back to closing this up.
The basic problem, of course, is that we took the easy drug money away from these guys, and now they're going. They're becoming data merchants, and it's like your email address, your passwords, your personal information.
Yeah, they became criminals because we took more legit. They were, in their mind, they really thought it was legitimate because they were actually providing a public service to the Americans that needed it, right?
Yeah,
so I'm sure.
Yeah, most of them saw themselves just being clever fellows who were making money on the internet, not as being anything.
Yeah, they didn't see themselves as criminals. And then we turned them into, well, okay, you see me as a criminal. I'm going to be a criminal. So, you know, in closing here, I want to talk a little more about the Russian cybercrime, because we have all these issues with Russia right now. And how much do you think they have stuff in our, you know, and what's interesting is Snowden actually was in Russia they were keeping him safe for a while. So what was that about?
Yeah. Well, you know, here's the thing, that, okay, so the Russian cybercrime industry and the Russian espionage agency and the Russian government are very closely interrelated. That in a lot of cases, you know, it's like ex-KGB guys who get into the Russian cybercrime groups, but let's just say that they're all connected very much in the Sicilian model, you know, where they're, you know, the guys that run everything know the guys that are doing this stuff, and it's all, you know, wink and a nod, and we're well aware of what's going on kind of a thing. So, what's happened, you know, I mean, in a very significant way, if the Russian government wants to create some kind of problem on the internet, they can do that just by asking their friends, you know, to kind of like tune it up for that type of an attack. So you really, you know, got to kind of wonder. One of the things that was sort of interesting at the end of the timeline that Brian Krebs was talking about is that the legitimate information technology, you know, software development businesses are legitimate, you know, like Kaspersky, for instance, which is a fine security product that's out of Russia. Younger programmers are being hired by straight companies, and so it's creating a problem for these, you know, criminal enterprises to find software coders to do their work, because it's
so much more lucrative to be a criminal
between getting a straight job. Well, in some cases, maybe not that much. By the time they get through paying for everything, you know, they're just
they're making
good money, but not, shall we say, a whole lot better than you would working a straight
then job. I don't know why they would do that. I think that's dumb.
Yeah.
And to me, it's dumb.
And what was sort of funny is one of these guys actually did that. He left his cybercrime business to his partner and got a straight job and said, I just don't want to monkey with it anymore. I'm trying to raise a family and I'm tired of running and hiding and, you know, I'm just going to go straight.
That's good. And that's a good story. Well, if you can make a living straight, most people will do that.
Sure. Absolutely.
You know, people don't want to be criminals. They don't want it, but if they have to provide for their family, they're going to fall back. And so government has too many obstacles and it's too hard to make a living, you are going to create criminals, a criminal class by default. That's the way it is. So if you have too many criminals, that means that your country's corrupt and you are creating too many problems. So the more corrupt a government and more obstacles a government creates, the more criminals you're going to create, because they can't make a living doing things legitimately. And everybody wants to, not everybody, but the majority of people want to be legitimate citizens and making money the right way. But so you have to turn around and point the finger at the government for just creating too many obstacles and being a big problem instead of a vehicle to help people.
Yeah, exactly.
So, well, you know what, Bob? This is awesome. You know, people should be aware that you do. You go in, you give seminars, you talk to companies, you do these things. Like I have you here, you can go and talk to other companies and educate their executives on what's really going on in the world.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
A big focus of what we do involves training, because, you know, training staff, training management, have you what to look out for, because quite frankly, as good as the tools are in terms of like blocking and tackling and keeping the bad guys out, the fact of the matter is that without training, they're going to get in, because most of the time it involves just fooling somebody into, you know, clicking a link on an email or doing some other silly thing that seems perfectly normal.
Yeah. So most of it is just dumb stuff that your employees do because they just don't know. And if they were just trained, they just wouldn't make that click, and you'd be, 95% safer just by having basic training for all your employees?
Yeah, exactly.
And don't you have some stats on how much money a company loses by not having training?
Yeah, the average last year, well, the average loss last year to all forms of malicious cyber activity was about $1,500 per employee.
So you can significantly reduce that by just educating your employees.
Yeah, you have to teach them, you know, how to recognize attempts to gain access to the network. And it's kind of like, okay, so we've got the machines are, the perimeter's hardened and all the machines are hardened. Now we have to harden the people a little bit because people tend to be trusting and believe what they're told. And, you get a realistic looking email from, say, FedEx or something like that. And, and you click on the link to find out what's going on with your package and then, oops, and now you've got malware in there into your networks.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point. You said that people are trusting, and I really do think that, people are starting to wake up with all the information that's out there. But in general, people still are very trusting of the government. They're trusting of the institutions. And it just because it says it's from a FedEx or from a trusting institution, as if there are any trusting institutions. I was going to say, just because people, people are very trusting. And so just because it comes from something that's trusting, if I don't know if there's many trusting institutions anymore, but in the mind's eye of people, and even our institutions, they're not going to put out bad email. The majority of them aren't. And people just need to be educated on the fact that, they're just naive. And so if you could just get them to understand that this is not necessarily what it appears to be. And even young people, I know my kids, they're completely trusting.
Yeah. And the thing that was so cool about this book is that for the people who want to, I always get the question, why are they doing this? What's this all about? And, the short answer is, well, it's about making money. But this book goes into such detail about just exactly how it all happens and, how they get in the first place, what they're doing, why they're doing it, how they're carrying it off. All of a sudden it all kind of came together, in a way that, you can see the entire enterprise from end to end and edge to edge. And it all of a sudden just becomes like, well, geez, this is just a really clever group of guys, figuring out how
doing
to make
business.
The internet work. Yeah.
Yeah. They're not legitimate. They're a mob type business using the internet. Well, you need to write a book. You have all this wealth of knowledge, and I think your books would sell. So another venture maybe that you could do.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I've got, of course, my security blog out there on
yes, you do. Yep.
Wise Guys Tech Talk. But
how can people get to your blog?
Yeah, go to bobwiseguy.com, bobwizgui.com, and you're there. And
they can get your contact information from there as well, right?
Absolutely.
Because I'm going to add you to the radio page as well, but just so they know, once again, what is it, Bob? Repeat the...
Yeah, B-O-B-W-Y-Z, as in zebra, G-U-Y-S, or G-U-Y.com, no less.
Okay, and you have just a ton of information on your blog. How often do you update it?
Typically, I'm posting 2 to 3 articles a week.
Okay.
And then I have an off-topic thing on Sunday that I call Sunday Funnies, and it's usually just some humorous little something that's got nothing to do with computers. But there's 2 to 3, primarily computer security focused, but in most cases it's computer something.
Okay. Well, good. I've been there a few times, and it's just more than a few times. I get a lot of my information from that.
Thanks.
Well, thanks, Bob. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Sarah. Thanks for inviting me again. And
you're going to be a regular. You are going to be a regular every couple months. I got to have you back, and we got to talk about what's going on in the cybercrime world.
That'd be super.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon, Bob. Have a great day.
Bye now.
While this is a fun topic for me to discuss, it can get very serious. As a business leader, it's important to get educated on these issues, train your employees, and guard your data and assets. The last thing you need is to be held up for days without access to your bank account or to customer information. I think we all know how bad that would be. Okay, so that's it for now. Have a wonderful day.